0818-715-815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. And I'm going to go straight away now to Elaine. Elaine, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Elaine, your story, you have been through an extraordinarily traumatic event. Take us back to the last weekend, the weekend before last.
So we flew out to Turkey for a family holiday to the region of Alanya. We booked a package holiday and we were super excited to be going away. We arrived and everything was good, not a bother. We were having a lovely time. We were there a week when things suddenly changed.
And just to tell people, it was yourself, your husband and your two children.
That's right.
What
myself,
age is...
my husband and my two children. My children are 10 and 11.
Okay. Okay. So you're having a fabulous time. Take us up to the night that this event happened.
Well, basically, we had been out of the resort all day, had a lovely day and returned to the resort. And it was late drinks at the bar. So there was two couples at the bar, like outside at the pool area, one of which we had been socialising with the night before. And our kids had played with their kids and they were lovely. They were an English couple. And we when we seen them, they kind of waved at us to say, come and have a drink with us. So we did. We went to the bar, we ordered a drink, and it was the last drink before the bar closed. We were just basically chatting away. I was chatting to two lads and the two daddies from the couples, and Phil was my partner. He was a little bit behind me, and he was talking to the two men. Two men came literally out of nowhere. Big, tall, burly men, kind of well over 6 foot. And myself and the two men I was speaking to, we were talking about football because I love football, and we were talking about the Liverpool match and what have you. And I kind of thought it was a bit strange. They were standing behind us, but weren't kind of in our conversation, but were like listening. And I kind of signaled to Dean and I said, which is one of the lads, I said, do you know these guys? And he was, no. And everything basically changed. They got down into my face and said to me, shut the F up. And I kind of went, excuse me? And again, he repeated, shut the F up. So at that point, I walked over to Phil because it was kind of aggressive. And I told Phil what had happened, and he walked over towards the men and he said, is there a problem, lad? And literally in that moment, everything changed. The two men attacked Phil. It was absolutely horrendous. The children were screaming. They basically grabbed Phil an arm each. They were tackling him to the ground. The other two guys who I'd been speaking to, Dean and Mike, were trying to help Phil. In the midst of all this, I ran to grab my children. Another man came out of nowhere and was trying to pick up one of the other children that was there, threw a towel over her head, tried to pick her up and run. Phil was screaming at the top of his voice to get the kids back to the hotel to safety because it was madness. It was just pure and sheer and utter panic. And we basically were subjected to that for, I don't even know how long. It was just so, there was so much panic. I don't know how long we were outside for. But the whole time we were outside, there was punches been thrown, people been pushed around, kids were pushed around, kids were slapped. And we were trying to get back to the hotel. And when Phil managed to break free from these two men, we ran towards the lobby. When we were running towards the lobby, there was like a turnstile you had to go through. We made it through the turnstile and one of the men grabbed Phil and tried to drag him back out through the turnstile, but he was too strong. And we got into the lobby and ran straight to the lift. We were basically in the lift trying to move the lift.
And just to be clear, this is yourself, your partner and your kids.
And
you had your
children,
kids.
Okay. Yeah, my two children were clutched onto my arms and we were running like nobody's business to try to get back into the lobby.
And your kids must have been terrified.
My poor kids were absolutely terrified. When we got into the lift, Lucy was on her knee It was absolutely harrowing. Lucy was literally on her knees with her hands together begging, please don't hurt my father. Please don't hurt my father. My father's a good man. Somebody call the police. Somebody call the police. All the while, these guys did not relent. They were beating the crap out of myself and Phil. They were trying to drag us out of the lift, but Phil was clutched onto either the pole either side of the lift. And he was just basically gripped onto it so he wouldn't let go. I was in front of Phil and one of my children. I don't know how she thought, but she did. She kicked one of the men, ran out of the lift. She grabbed her brother and the two of them ran to the toilet. The toilet was literally beside the lift. And my son had my phone and he dialed 911. And they were on a call with an operator, a Turkish operator, to emergency services for 6 minutes and 25 seconds, trying to explain where we were. They were spelling out the name of the hotel and the region we were in. And they were asking for police to come.
Elaine, it's extraordinary presence of mind for your children. Again, remind us, what ages are they again?
10 and 11.
And they knew to dial 911 and...
Do you know, something crazy happened on the way over. My daughter said to me, Mom, if we needed emergency services, what number would we call, 999 or 911? And I had said to her, 911 is universal, so I think wherever you are in the world, 911 works.
And she remembered that.
I know that she had to use, she was going to have to use that. Yes, she remembered it. She herself and her brother were absolutely amazing. They were just so brave.
That is, I just cannot imagine the terror and the trauma.
The terror.
And again, just the shock of it, because this had come out of absolutely nowhere.
Nowhere. We were literally just talking. I have no idea why they targeted us. At the time, I had no idea why they targeted us. I do know now that I really honestly believe that it was to create a distraction so they could try and abduct one of the children.
And that is the only logic you can put onto how you were dragged into this.
The only logic, exactly. It was just the most harrowing experience we have ever had. It was terrible. It was just terrible.
Okay, will you stay with us there, Elaine? And I just want to explain to people, as you explained, we're talking about a resort, a hotel you were in Antalya, which is a very massive resort city in Turkey. We're not going to name the hotel where this happened now, because we're talking to them. We're trying to get a response from them about the events that happened while you were there, and we may bring you more on that. They're promising us a statement, so hopefully we will be able to bring you that. But you stay there, Elaine, because...
Will do.
Because I have Dean on another line. Dean, good afternoon, Dean.
Hi there, you okay?
Dean, you were one of the other couples that Elaine mentioned there. You were that English couple that Elaine was talking about at the bar.
Yes.
So will you take me back to where you were when all of this happened and your recollections of how that evening unfolded?
Yes, of course. Like Elaine said, we was all at the outside bar near the pool area, just having a drink. We had met this other English couple who it was their first night, who Mike and Pila, and we was talking to them when Elaine and Phil came back from the town because they'd been out all day. And we saw them the previous night, so we waved at them and then they came over and had a drink with us. And it was all happy, we was all enjoying ourselves. When literally, like Elaine said, we was just discussing football at the time and these two Turkish men just appeared. Like, I didn't even see them walk over. It was just like right next to us. So I just tried to carry on my conversation with Elaine. But they was just stood next to us, just with like their arms folded, looking at us. So I just kind of said to them, you know, are you all right? Is everything okay? And at that point, he just started copying things I was saying and getting in my face with it. Started being a bit aggressive, started effing and blinding at us. And it got a bit scary. So Elaine obviously then went over to Phil, to get him to come over because they was both like really attacking me kind of thing. You know, it started getting a bit push and shove. And then all of a sudden it all kicked off. They was trying to grab Phil and it just all went chaotic when I heard screams from behind me. So as I turned, I saw that third man go over to my two-year-old daughter that was sat on a chair and put a towel over her and picked her up.
Okay, so it was your child, it was your daughter.
Yes, it was, yes.
And you could see that from the melee that you were in, you could see away from you.
Well, yeah, I was no more than 5 metres away. So I saw that guy go over and put a towel straight over her head and pick her up and start running off. And obviously I was occupied with these other two that was getting aggressive with me and Phil and Mike. And yeah, and I was terrified, to be honest. And
I actually just cannot put myself in the head of somebody watching a towel being put over. What age is your daughter?
Two. Yeah.
Watching a towel being thrown over my daughter's head. And did they reach down and picked her up at that point?
Yes, it was that third man who just literally came out of nowhere and just put it over and picked her up. And so then after seeing all this, it was all going mad. Everyone was screaming. The kids started crying. And, you know, it was very, very scary. So it all kind of started getting a bit violent. Like Elaine was saying, the men was just starting to show no remorse with anyone. And even the kids, they were pushing and shoving and swinging arms around. So I managed to get away a little bit. And then I remember hearing the two Turkish men shout, like in really deep voices, you know, to come and chase me. So they started running after me. So obviously I turned away to run away and hid round a corner to then see my 8-year-old son walk past crying his eyes out. So I ran over and I grabbed him, brought him with me around the corner.
And where was your partner, Sophie? At this point.
She was in the middle of this with I think it was Pila and Elaine at the time, and the children.
She was with the other children, basically.
Yeah, she was with the other children, and I think it was actually some German people that were there that actually managed to retrieve my daughter off this man.
Okay, so just to place everyone then, so there's you are now with your son.
Yes.
Sort of hiding, basically.
Basically, yes, round a corner.
Okay.
And I saw the men that was chasing us run past us, and I saw Mike, who was holding his child. I'm not sure which child it was, but he was holding his child, and they ran over to him and started hitting him and started, you know, being aggressive towards him. And I remember Mike shouting, you know, I've got my children in my arm. What are you doing? Get off me. So I saw this as an opportunity to get my son, run back to my family. So I did, and I ran back to where we came from and went to the lobby. Elaine and Phil, Lucy and George, there was nowhere to be seen.
At this stage, you didn't know where Evie was, where your daughter was?
No. I didn't know where she was. And I was panicking. So I went to the lobby. We were screaming, shouting, when I saw two German girls come out of a bush who had actually took our daughter and hid her in a bush away from it all with my other son, who's 5.
So they were just total strangers. You had never met them before?
No, never met them before, no.
And what did they tell you? What had happened?
They told me that they just saw it all happening, that someone tried to take my daughter and stuff. So they just took it off their own and got my children and hid them in a bush until, you know, they was all running off. So I went, thank you so much. I grabbed all my family and said, look, let's go upstairs. Let's go back to the room. I think it's the safest place to be. So as I walked in there, I saw Elaine, Phil and her two children in that lift with them guys holding them in there. And they were screaming, shouting, kids crying. So I went over to try and get them out. I said, look, leave them alone. Let them come out. What have we done wrong here? Like, I don't understand. And then the Turkish man got aggressive and walked up to me and then hit me with his right hand. So immediately I backed off, ran back outside of the lobby, with my family, and we just stood there with the German girls, and they were telling us everything that was happening. And it was then, like I said, timings, I have no idea. It was a blur. I don't know how long we was outside for, just trying to hide away. So then I just thought, look, let's try again and see if we can go to the room. And then there was nobody there. They wasn't in the lift. So we ran straight in. I said, look, let's get to the lift. And I think it was actually Mike's partner, Peeler, who was with us at the time with her baby as well. And we ran into that lift and said, look, let's go to the room. And as the doors were about to close, them Turkish men saw us and ran over again and tried to pull me out of the lift while I was holding my two-year-old, trying to drag me out. My partner, seeing this, you know, dug a nails in him and shoved him out of the lift, telling him to get off us.
So having, just again, because there's a lot of action happening here, and just to be clear, so you having retrieved Evie, your two-year-old,
yeah.
from
yeah.
these German tourists, these German girls who had somehow managed to get this child back off these men.
Yes.
They then came after you again and again tried to pull her out of your arms.
Yes, they tried to get her again. But obviously I was just holding my own, just staying in that lift. They managed to get off us. And then when the doors were closing again, he put his hands in and grabbed my daughter's legs to try and snatch her out of my arms while the doors were closing. But then we got him out, the doors closed, and then we went up to the room, and then I just stayed in that room.
Have you any idea, because as you say, you had three children with you?
Yes, I had three, yes.
And Elaine and Phil had two children, and I know that Mike and Pila had three other children, I think. Have you any idea of why they were so focused on Evie?
I have no idea. The only thing I can think of is that... she's a two-year-old girl with really, really long blonde hair and blue eyes and cute as oat, you know. I can't think of any other reason. I just think it was that reason.
She just stood out, you think?
Yeah, I think she'd like, because literally from the whole holiday, they were showing Evie a lot of attention, everybody there. Everyone was like saying, you know, we call her Candy in this country and touching her constantly, and they all remembered her name and didn't know ours. You know, it was very, very weird.
She just stood out because she was so fair-skinned and fair-haired. And
yes, I think that's the reason, yeah.
So terrifying. Dean, I've got... I can go to Mike now, I think. Mike, good afternoon.
Hello, how are you?
Mike, it's so hard to get your head around this, you know, this incident, if I can call it an incident. You were at the bar with Elaine and Dean, were you?
Yes, I was, yes.
And had you any sense of these men until they started to get aggressive with you?
No, I mean, as Dean rightfully said, they literally turned up out of nowhere. They didn't say anything. They just started pushing Elaine. I was there and I'm still trying to get my head around it. It was terrifying, horrible.
And again, remind us, you had three kids with you on holidays?
Yeah, I had my baby boy, he's one, my boy who is four, and my wife's daughter who is 10.
And where were they when all of this was kicking off?
again, for the most of it, all the kids we were trying to keep in one area so we knew where they all were, except poor Evie. I remember when the men started chasing us and everybody was running, as Dean mentioned, when the Turkish man hit Marley, I remember seeing my 10-year-old stepdaughter trying to run and push a pram with a 1-year-old in it, and it was always horrible.
She was trying to get your baby away.
She was trying to get my baby away. My wife had then just turned up. She just wanted the kids, the Turkish man. I'd stopped and put my hands in the air with Marley in my arms. The Turkish man had jabbed my wife a couple of times in the throat. She was hit in the stomach, grabbed by the arms. She just wanted the kids.
And do you think they were was there an attempt to go after your children, or you just think you were, this was all part of this distraction, this...
Honestly, I couldn't tell you. I know later on in the week that there was a couple there, and they kept stroking Mav, saying my baby boy, who's one, saying how beautiful he was, and you know, kept touching him and stuff. We actually left just after that because it freaked us out a little bit. So I don't know.
And how, as you say, that was, you had just arrived, hadn't you, Mike?
Yeah, we'd literally been there 3 hours.
Oh my God.
Three hours.
And were you there? Did you stay after that? Were you able to move?
Financially, to get flights home, it was just impossible. It was far too expensive. So what I actually did the following morning, I took it upon myself. I went and spoke to the manager. I said to the manager, I want to go and speak to the security guard to see, you know, what happened, what it was all about, why, put my point across, sort of ease the tension, because I still had another week there. As we were walking over to the security guy, he phoned up the manager literally as we was 15, 20 feet away. Don't know what they said because it wasn't in English. Went over there. I tried to sort of engage with them. Very little English was spoken. And I said to the manager, look, maybe next time just come and talk rather than throw people about or explain the situation. Show ID, wear a uniform, etc., etc.
And just to be clear, Mike, we have no idea. I mean, these men, they initially, there might have been some sense that they were security guys, but we have no idea of where they came from or what connection they had with anybody.
So initially, they just turned up in civilian clothing. There was no ID. There was no sense that they were even security. They were in civilian clothing. They were throwing English people around. They were picking up kids. They were doing this and they were doing that. And we had no idea who they were. And then there was screams that they were police. So they were saying they were police. And then we didn't know until the following morning that they were actually security.
Yes, again, we can't. I can't corroborate that from this juncture. But as you say, there was a huge amount of confusion as to where these men came from or what connection, if any, they had with the hotel. And as I say, we are in contact with that hotel and we're trying to establish, you know, the parameters of this and the facts of this. And as I say, we will hopefully be able to bring a statement from that hotel in relation to these issues. But from your point of view, all you know is that all of these strange men, very burly men, are physically assaulting yourself and your partner and children. How are your children after that?
That night, my stepdaughter, she woke up and was physically sick through worry. My son has, my 4-year-old has slept in bed with me and my wife literally every night since. I came up to him last night and he said, Dad, I just can't get comfortable. I'm still scared. That's horrible as a dad.
Yeah, you can only imagine trying to process that from a child's eyes. It's hard enough as an adult.
I don't even know how to explain it to him. as his father, you know, I feel like I failed him.
It's just such a traumatic thing. And did you call the police? Well, we know. Hang on, I'll go back to Elaine. Sorry, Mike, can you hang on with me? Because I want to go back to Elaine and ask you about that phone call that your children made to 911. What came of that?
The police arrived. Like Mike has said, the whole time frame is just a blur. The hotel, we know, didn't contact the police because the next day I contacted the Irish Embassy to let them know what had happened, and they had told us that there was no report made from the hotel to the Turkish police. So the police that came as a result of the phone call that my children made to 911.
And what happened when the police arrived?
When the police arrived, the whole mood changed in the lobby, I think, because the men totally relaxed, as in they weren't forceful with us once the police had arrived. I was pleading. I was asking, can I tell you what happened? Can I tell you what happened? The main thing I wanted to get across was not that we had been beaten up. Somebody had tried to take a child. Nobody could listen because nobody had any English.
And I know, Elaine, you have. Was it yourselves that reported it to the Gardaí? Because we have spoken with
it. It was indeed.
Yeah,
it was the day we came home on Wednesday. And on Thursday, we went straight to the Gardaí to report this, to have a flag with Interpol, because we are so scared that this is going to happen to somebody else.
We know, and we have spoken to the guards, and they have confirmed that they have passed it on to the Interpol on guard, the Shikana Interpol section, for onward transmission to the relevant authorities. So we know that it has been passed on, Elaine.
And the guards here were fantastic. I must say that they actually were really, really sympathetic, and they were fantastic, and they've been in communication with us since we made that report. And I have to say, we actually don't know how lucky we are here. We're officials. I felt so unsafe there, and I didn't feel safe until I came home. And people listened to me. People that had the power to actually do something listened.
And Elaine, how are your kids? Your amazing kids.
They're actually okay. And my daughter Lucy is such a strong human. I am in awe of her. George is still slightly scared. We're getting the odd dad, I'm still a little bit scared type of a thing. But overall, they're quite okay. And I think if they need some sort of post-traumatic stress treatment later on, or they need to talk to anybody later on, I put that in process already. I went and I spoke to somebody, and we have been referred for some post-traumatic stress treatment, because I myself am finding this extremely hard to process. And although the kids may look like they're okay, I don't know if 3 weeks down the line something's going to come up, or the next time we say we're planning a holiday, is it going to cause them some stress and worry?
But just for her to see, and I think I have Phil. I can talk to Phil as well. Partner, Elaine. Phil, are you there?
I am. Yeah. How are you?
The line that got me from Elaine's story was talking about going into that lift and your little girl begging them not to hurt you.
Yeah. Yeah. Still sending shivers down my spine. Something I'll never forget.
And
absolutely horrific.
When obviously the first you knew of it was when Elaine came to you and said something's kicking off over here.
The first thing I noticed, I didn't notice the guys. I was in a conversation with the two girls there, and she came over to me, "Phil, these guys are getting aggressive. They're after telling me to shut the F up." And I looked over, they're two huge guys, 6'6" and above, maybe 14 to 18 stone each. So I said, "Right, who are these guys? They must have something to do with the hotel, maybe." The hotel is surrounded by a wall. There's security on all four gates. Surely there's no one can come in and out of here. We're in the safe zone. We're in the resort. So I walked over, and I was full sure we were going to be told, "Get up to bed, it's too late." I said, "Sorry, guys, what's the problem here?" And with that, each of them grabbed me by an arm, plunged me to the ground on my knees, and started pounding me in the stomach with a fist each. I immediately tried to jump up, scream, "Get the kids to the hotel." For some reason, just the instant it happened, I knew they were there for our kids, whether they were mine, someone else's. Just something told me the kids are in danger. I kept screaming everyone to run, get to the hotel. I can't really remember much of what went on until we got to the turnstile. I got Elaine and the kids through the turnstile. The guys grabbed me. I turned around. They tore my clothes off. I managed to get away into the hotel. I pushed all the family into the lift, Elaine and the two kids. Turned around, me and Elaine frantically banging the buttons, closed the door, the doors were closed, and the two guys come up, opened the door. There's a handrail that goes around every lift inside, and I stood at the front door and I grabbed a handrail on both sides. And the whole time that this was going on, I wasn't aware that Elaine and the kids had escaped the lift. I was full sure they were behind me and that I was protecting them from these men. And they'd have to shoot me in the head to get me out of that lift, to be honest with you. not for love nor money, but he taken me and my kids, my wife out of that lift. Little did I know they had already escaped. Yeah. This went on, felt like hours. Eventually, the police came in. Soon as they came in, everything changed. Both everyone's demeanour changed, the attitude, the voices, everything. I was told to get out of the lift. There's an English, a London cab driver there. His name is Haroon, and he could speak Turkish. And he said to me, "Do exactly as I say, and you'll survive this." There are words that I will never, ever forget. And I was told to get out of the lift, face down, hands and arms spread. The police never spoke to me. Something was pressed to the back of my head. I don't know if it was one of the guys pushing me to the ground or a gun being put to my head. I was full sure that I was being held to the ground at gunpoint. Then the lobby was cleared of everyone, apart from maybe three or four men, residents that were there. And then those couple of guys were cleared out. One of the men who attacked us, you have to understand, these two men stood there with six police officers discussing what had happened, looked over CCTV footage, and then left with no arrests made or questions asked. And I don't know who these men were, but they knew the police. Then it was just me and a Russian guy who was intervening to help us. I don't know his name. Thank him very much. He done his best for us. The two of us then were marched outside. He was about 10 or 15 feet ahead of me. The cops had left. There was one police officer behind me, and he started following me out. And I was full sure, Jesus Christ, we're being marched out here. We're either going to be shot or we're going to be taken away to a Turkish prison, and I won't be seen for 2 years. So I got about 10, 11 feet out, and I turned on my heels and I bolted inside. The Turkish police officer that was behind me, he stood to one side and let me escape. I ran up the stairs to the third floor, screaming for Elaine, trying to find her and the kids. I had no idea that Dean had actually bundled my family into the hotel room. I would be forever grateful to that man for that. I couldn't find them. I looked out the window at the stairwell and I seen the police officer and one of these other men come back inside. I panicked even more. Jesus, they're coming to get me. I ran up another three flights of stairs, I think two or three flights of stairs, and I came across a fold up cot bed, and it was in front of a glass panel door. And I was, what is that doing there? I think to myself, I pulled the cot bed, I rattled the door, it opened inwards, it was a closet. I went in, I pulled the cot behind me, and I closed the door, and I hid there for an hour and a half until I was safe, knew it was safe to come out. When I came out, I'm back down to the third floor, and Elaine must have been peeping her head in and out the door for the whole hour and a half I was missing. The guys see me, they're all waving out the door. I ran down and then was just all hugs and kisses. I walked over, I kissed Evie. Jesus, it's just, oh, well.
It's like, it's the way you describe it, even, it's like one of those movies where...
It sounds like something from Taken. That's exactly what it sounds like. It sounds like a made-up fantasy story for a book or a movie.
But it actually happened.
It was reality.
Phil, will you stay there? And all of you, please stay there. Hopefully we'll be able to speak to Harum, that taxi driver that you mentioned there. But we'll have to take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Okay, I was hoping to get Harum there, but we'll try and get him again. Elaine, you were listening to Phil there. I mean, between the two of you talking this through since you got home, it's just trying to piece it all together. It must be... It's so difficult just from snatches of, you know, when you're in a high-stress situation like that to try and put it all back together in a timeline.
It is, and I don't think we still managed to even get the timeline right. I mean, how we got back in contact with Mike was we looked at TripAdvisor yesterday to see had anybody posted any reviews about the hotel. And when I seen my review about the hotel, I was reading through and I said, oh my God, that's actually about us. This is the guy that I was speaking to at the bar. And I contacted him through Facebook. And I'll be honest with you, our three families, myself, Phil, Mike and Pila, Dean and Sophie, have been a massive comfort for each other in the last few days. You feel like you're not going mad and you're not alone now, that people actually were involved in this. You just think nobody's going to believe this.
It is. I mean, it is such an extraordinary story. Now, I have to say, I did see another case of an allegation that a child had been abducted from another hotel in that city, in Antalya, in Turkey, going back to 2018.
I've seen it too.
The child was age five, little girl, abducted from a hotel kids club in Turkey. And again, she was kind of found almost by accident and 40 minutes later, and there was no further police action taken in relation to that case. That is according to this report that we picked up today. But I'm going to bring in Dean again, because Dean, it was your daughter, yourself and your partner Sophie. How have you been coping with the aftermath of this?
We haven't really. We've not really had time to discuss it with each other, as the children have been there the whole time. So, you know, we didn't want to panic them at all by talking about it. But my youngest two, you know, the 2 and 5, they don't really understand what was happening. But my eldest, he knew. And like the next day, we just stayed in the hotel room. We didn't even go out. Like, he didn't even want to go to the pool or anything. Like, we just stayed in the room all day.
What age is your eldest again, Dean?
8.
Okay, so absolutely would completely have understood what was going on around him. Well, not understood it, but have taken it in and seen what was happening. Did you have Longmore in the resort after this?
We actually left on Friday. So we was there for a good 5 days afterwards. But luckily, you know, Mike and Pila was there, and we literally stayed together the whole holiday. And just looked out for each other. They like were knocking on each other's door to see if they wanted to go for dinner and things like that. So we kept each other safe and, you know, comforted each other really. So I'm grateful that they were there, to be honest.
Okay, Dean, you stay there again. I've got Haroom, if I've got that right. Haroom, good afternoon.
Yeah, hello there. Good afternoon.
Yeah, Haroom, Phil mentioned you there. He was very, very grateful to you. Now, as I understand it, you did not see Dean's little girl being taken, but you witnessed a lot of the other activity that night.
Yeah, that's correct. I saw that night that they was beating the children, slapping on the face, and women, they treat the women very badly, and they was beating the women also there. And they have no respect for children and women at all. And, like, that was a very bad situation that night. Like, as Mr. Dean told you the situation, I got the same thing to tell you guys also. Like, the situation was not right over there. They're treating us not so in the right way, how we was expecting that.
And you intervened, you were there when Elaine and Philip were being attacked in the lift.
Yes, I was there, and I was trying to make the situation calm down on that night. And they was that guy was really aggressive, and he was beating Philip and his wife also in the lift. And till the military police came over, and they was more worse than the security guy. Like, they was even worse, because I think they was friends on each other, the police and that guy. And because 1 week before, I saw them sitting to have the tea outside the hotel, and I think they was friends on each other. And when the police came over, and there was a slapping on the face of people, Sema Wo was there to helping. And yeah, that was not right on that night.
Okay. And again, as I say, we're trying to get some account from the hotel in relation to this, and we can't verify who knew who or, you know, who was friends with who. But you did see the German girls who actually rescued little Evie.
Yes, I saw the German ladies, because that time that person was beating and pushing Mr. Philip and his wife through the gate. And the German ladies came behind of me, because I ran first toward them to help them. And then the German ladies came behind me. And after that, the German ladies took the baby and gave them the coat to stay warm and take them away from the situation, take them far away from there, from the position.
Yeah, so they intervened at that time. Okay, yeah. Okay. I'm going to have to take another break. Haru, many thanks for that. I'm going to take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I just want to say before we leave this, thank you all, Elaine, Dean, Philip, Mike, for sharing what is an extremely, extremely distressing story. Elaine, I know you wanted to tell the story because you wanted other parents to know about this.
Yes, that was the main reason Phil contacted you guys. We needed people to know that this happens and that this could be them. You book a holiday for fun, for excitement, for a break, to relax. You don't expect something like this to happen. And I said to myself, if I ever read that something like this happened in that region again, I'd never forgive myself if I hadn't have tried to highlight it. I mean, this could be anybody. That I don't think we were the first, and I certainly don't think we'll be the last. I do agree that this happens rarely, but rarely is too much.
Yeah, and we should say that, of course. You know, it would have to be a very, very rare event, and we don't want to frighten people, indeed.
Exactly. My aim is not to frighten people, it's to make people aware. I mean, we were very, very lucky that we hadn't been drinking all day, and we weren't drunk, and we had our senses about us. But the next person that this happens to, it might not be so lucky.
Yeah.
It's just scary, so scary.
Yeah, Elaine, many thanks. Dean, thank you so much for telling your story and telling Evie's story. And I hope all of your families and all of your children can put this behind you. And thank you for, putting out, sharing that story for the best possible reasons.
No, that's okay. You're welcome.
Okay, we'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Or text us on 51551. Now, to cut something completely different, I want to go to Mary. Mary, good afternoon to you.
Hello, good afternoon.
Mary, you are living in a lovely thatched cottage.
I am. I've been very lucky to be renting a most beautiful thatched cottage for the last 7 years. That's right.
And you'd like to buy it?
I would. And I'm in the process. I'm very excited that I'm in the process of buying it at the moment. And I suppose I've just come up against what I hope won't be a wall, but it feels like it at the moment, which is trying to get house insurance for a thatched cottage, which is necessary in order to get a mortgage. So that's what I've been discovering the last few weeks.
You can't get the insurance for the thatched cottage?
So far, the usual thing is when you go to get a mortgage that you're told, okay, now what you can be doing while you're waiting for things to go through is you do your research on getting house insurance and you get your quotes. So I have rang lots of different insurance companies. At the start, there was not really a problem. It was, say, a month ago. I just out of interest, just to get an idea of how much I had rang around. And they'd said to me, it's difficult to get the insurance for thatch, and there's a lot of things you have to do, like you have to get an electrician to check the house, and is to have a chimney sweep come in and look at your chimney, all these different things. And I said, right, that's okay, we'll do that. And I knew it would be very expensive as well. I said, that's okay. But then I kind of went about doing all those jobs, just making sure that I'd be ready to go for insurance. And I just called one of the insurance companies one day, just a few weeks ago, to be told that the insurer, the main insurer that was covering thatched cottages, they've stopped taking on new business. And so it just makes me very worried that when I go to draw down the mortgage, will I be able to get insurance? I'm hoping that something will be in place, but I can't be the only one that's trying to buy a thatched cottage in Ireland and coming up against this issue. So it's worrying really more than anything, because to come so close to what is really a dream to buy this house, you know.
And presumably there is no insurance. It's not insured currently then, is it?
It is. So my hope, yeah, so that's what we hope, is that the current insurer might be able to continue it. But as a rule at the moment, insurance companies are not taking on new business for thatch. That's kind of like the last straw, the fingers crossed. But outside of that, that's the worrying thing, that I just keep getting told, no, we don't do thatch insurance. And as well, even if I do, hopefully that we get sorted, that may, because it is insured, maybe if it can be carried on. But what do we do then? Because every year when you have a mortgage, you have to have your house, you have to show your house insurance. And what do you do then if there's no companies taking your business, and the one that you're with, if they
pull out of the market, yeah.
Yeah, and this, I suppose this has probably come to a head now, because that insurer is no longer taking your business. But I know from chatting to people that they've had awful issues trying to get insurance for thatched buildings for many, many years until now.
And tell me, Mary, what is it about the thatch that you know, draws you in? Why is it a dream for you to live in this thatched cottage?
Oh, well, I'm in it now, and it's the cosiest, most peaceful building. I suppose it's the look of it is a big thing. Every time I round the corner there and go in the gate and I see it, I just kind of say, oh, I'm home. I see the beautiful thatch, and it's white with red, kind of red outline on the windows. Inside it has the what I think are the original shutters. It's got, you know, the old sash windows. It's
a proper traditional Irish thatched cottage.
Stunning. It's a stunning, and it has outbuildings outside. So I have some hens and ducks, and it's just.
You're living the good life, Mary.
Yeah, well, it's lovely, and it's I suppose it's that lovely thing of feeling that you're in a building that has great history and heritage. And I suppose there's that kind of a feeling of wanting to kind of look after it. And I suppose that's why I think the idea of having trouble with insurance is I suppose such a worry as well, because in my case, I wouldn't be able to not have insurance. But I know there are people that have thatched houses and they have to not have insurance because either they can't get it or they've been quoted so much money that it just doesn't make sense. And that's a real worry, like what happens to those cottages if anything happens to them, is that the end of them?
Yeah, because I mean, it would be very stressful to be in that scenario if you weren't insured, or didn't know whether you could secure next year's insurance.
Absolutely. Yeah, I suppose what I'd feel about it is as well is that a lot of this structure and a lot of thatched houses are protected structures. And, you know, I suppose that's through our government that rightly they should be protected. And it means that when you live in them, you know, you need to look after them and keep them up. And that's right. But I suppose on the other side of it, it would be nice to feel that you'd never have to worry about insurance. It's not that, you know, if it's expensive, look, I'll pay that. It's more the idea that you have to worry, will I be able to get insurance for it? It just seems unfair, I suppose, when you ring up and I described the, you know, so many times until I realised it was the thatch was the thing. I described the house and where it was, and we'd all be going well. And, you know, next thing is they'd say, and does it have a standard roof? And you'd say thatch, and that would be the end of the conversation. Then they'd say, oh no, sorry, I can't help you. It feels such a shame for buildings that are such, you know, an iconic part of our heritage, that we go to Bunratty to see thatch cottages, we'll say. But this is a real one, and it's been lived in. And, you know, the idea that that you'd struggle to get insurance for it, I think it's a shame.
Do they need upkeep? Like, how do you maintain a thatched roof?
So I suppose I'm just kind of getting to know all this now, but my understanding of it is a good thatched roof that's done well could, if it's looked after, could last for 30 or 40 years. But you need to get the ridge done along the top. That's what I've been learning. So you need to do that, I think, every 10 years. So there is maintenance and upkeep and expense for sure. I suppose it's something that I'm aware of in buying this house. There's a little element of buying it that you kind of think, well, you know, it's not maybe the easiest house to live in, but maybe there's a satisfaction from looking after a piece of heritage.
You're
as
like
well.
You're a custodian, Mary.
I would feel that would be the case. Yeah, if I get, I mean, even already as it stands, renting it, I feel like that, in the sense of obviously my lovely landlady looks after it, but I, as a tenant, you know, try to do my best just to keep the place looking nice, because it's also kind of place that people kind of pull into the yard or pull into the drive and have a look in as well. And it's nice, you kind of feel like, I don't know, it's nice to kind of keep it looking well and everybody can enjoy it. It's kind of a little bit different in that way, I suppose.
Stay with me, Mary. I've got Katie on another line. Katie, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good. Have you come up against the same thing, Katie?
Yeah, Mary is certainly not alone in this, and it's probably really been going on years. I'm in a situation a little bit different to Mary, where it's actually my mother is struggling to get insurance. For years, I grew up in a thatched pub. So, like, the family business was a pub. Always in its heyday, the pub was, like, thriving, great crack, great nights out, real community. And everybody loved the thatched pub directly across the road from the church. So, like, so many wedding photographs, you name it, were taken outside.
Which pub was that, Katie?
Oh, well, I just prefer not to say.
Right, okay. Well, people might know anyway when you put it like
will.
That.
Yeah. So, but I suppose in recent years, it's always been a struggle for my mother to get insurance. They've never, ever had a claim. You know, nothing has ever been a problem. They've maintained this thatched roof off their own back for years on end. I would actually be the fourth generation to take over this building eventually. And, you know, you have this stumbling block for my mother where she can't get insurance. Last year, she got a letter from the brokers that she was with to say that the underwriters that had been taking her policy all along were leaving the market. And that was the last string of underwriters that were after leaving the market over the years. And Brexit really just put the nail in the coffin for a lot of attached insurance policies. So I think I must have rang every broker, every insurance person I could probably think of to try and see if I could get a quote of any description for her. And the best quote we got was, like, because it was a public house, you needed public liability. The public liability alone for the pub was over 7,500. And then you're talking about buildings and contents in a rural village was another 5,000. So if you break that out, you're looking at least 1,000 a month just for insurance. Now, this was to cover a public house which had been closed all year because of COVID restrictions. So my mother was isolated as it was with COVID. And then because she can't have insurance on the property, she's afraid to have anybody inside the doors. Because if anybody has a fall or anything, or anybody claims offer at all, she just doesn't have insurance to cover it because of a thatched roof.
Can you trade without public liability insurance?
You probably do if you're on your own risk. I don't know. It's not something we've ever done, you know. The pub is closed now because it was a very, very difficult decision to make.
And it was because of the insurance issue, was it?
The insurance, and like we were told that you might be able to source thatch insurance if you were a domestic building. So it was a difficult decision because this was one of the last businesses in the parish to close. So it went from a little village with three open pubs thriving and two shops to this one pub left open until COVID hit. And then when COVID and insurance combined, it was really difficult to sit. Very heartbreaking for my mother because, you know, it was a real community. Like, it was the only place that was left for people to go to except the church. You know, there's no place in the community now. It's not a decision she took easily because there was a certain amount of guilt. You know, like some people were, oh, when are you opening? And she was like, I just don't know when I can or if I can. And it's gone so long now, I think she's happier to stay closed, which is hard to take on, you know.
Yeah, the heart has gone out of that. Yeah, the social hub is a huge thing in a small community. And how recent is this issue coming up?
This issue is ongoing with years. I mean, she has letters going back to 2015 and back further again. But I've kind of taken on the reins, I suppose, since my father passed away, that I've been helping her out, you know, with the last year to try and get some sort of a grip on insurance. So I started up a petition last year and it's nearly up to 1,000 signatures. I've been on to the Oireachtas, the Central Bank, CCPC, any politician that will listen, councillors, heritage officers, you name it. I've tried every angle and everyone just seems to wash their hands of this, you know, with the Central Bank. But like, you know, I mean, they want you to preserve the heritage. And yes, they will give you some sort of grants to help with maintaining the roof, which are quite minimal in the grand scheme of the cost of keeping a thatched roof. But it is a help. But I mean, when it comes to insurance, there is nothing. Nobody wants to know anything about it.
How much does it cost to maintain a thatched roof?
Well, I suppose it depends on the type of reed you have. You know, I suppose you're looking at a couple of grand every few years, really, to try and get the top done and maybe get it sprayed or get netting put on it or, you know, and then every sort of maybe 20 plus years, you're looking at a big overhaul, which is another big expense. It could be anything, a good couple of thousand, even over 10,000-15,000, depending on what you have to get done.
And tell me, are there many thatchers? Is that what you call a person who does the thatcher? Many thatchers out there now?
Look, there probably is. You have to go looking, though, really looking, and you need to get a good thatcher. It's your home, it's your house. You want to make sure it's done right. And a lot of thatchers, I suppose it's kind of like a dying trade, if you like. I might be wrong on that. I'm just taking over the reins for my mum to try and help her out, so she would definitely be more in the know. But it's the waiting time to get people as well and to try and source the materials for it. There's a lot to take in. It's not straightforward as a slate roof.
And
the disparity between the slate roof and the thatched roof for a house insurance is phenomenal.
We did get on to the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage, important to say, and Heritage, because this would fall under that side of it. What they said to us was, this is after all your lobbying, no doubt, Katie, the department is aware of the challenges facing owners of thatched buildings in respect of securing insurance for their homes. And there's some more information there. It says the department is currently establishing a thatch steering group to address this question, amongst others. And goes on to say other detail about what, you know, how much they appreciate all of this. But it says the department is committed to investing in the preservation and continued use of thatched homes so that they remain a living part of our heritage and community life into the future.
That's great. But like, when are they planning on doing it? This has gone on with years and they know it. I have letters dating back to 2015 on this. It's action we need now, not all the talk they're talking, because talking is great, but it doesn't get them anywhere. We need action. We need it sooner. We need it much sooner than what they're planning on. You know, it's just not good enough. My mother is sleepless nights, worrying about the roof, about anybody having an injury in the place. Like, that's not good enough. This is her. She should be able to sit back and enjoy this stage of her life and not have these worries. What, her house should be her asset now. It's a liability. She can't do anything with it. It's ridiculous. It's just not good enough. Not good enough from our government.
Katie, I've got Paul on another line. Paul, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
You grew up in a thatched cottage.
I did indeed, yes. Seven of us, seven boys.
And where is that cottage now? Is it still on the go?
It is. My brother, he's not living in it, but he keeps it immaculate. It's in Sligo, between Enniscorn and Eastkey. And he did have it rented for a period, but he's not renting it anymore. So all we do is, if we're going out for weekends, we stay there, the family, you know.
Yeah, it's a base for you down at home, as they say.
Yeah.
And was it considered very special when you were growing up, the fact that you had?
Well, I can remember when I was a kid. This is back in the 60s now, or late 50s, early 60s. You'd have these tour buses coming along the road, and there's all those stop, and everybody get off, Americans taking pictures, and they even used to come into the house. My mother often invited them in to have a look around, you know.
And was it all traditional inside and out?
Oh, it was, yeah, all traditional, yeah. All traditional, yeah. These big thick walls and thatch. And my mother used to have it all, what we used to call whitewash. All the walls outside of the white, was kind of a lime.
A lime wash, yeah.
Yeah, she makes her water, and she my mother used to do it with a brush every summer.
You'd have
a half door on the front of it, you know.
Oh, you had the half door and everything. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah, and these small little windows with the big sashes, you know.
Did you have hens? Because, of course, that's what the half door was for, yeah.
Hens, geese, ducks. They'd walk into the kitchen, you know, no problem. Walk in and walk around and out again, you know.
Yeah.
And that time it was an open house, like neighbours would just walk in and sit down and have a cup of tea and chat. Oh, yeah, I remember. It was great memories.
And was there much in the upkeep of the thatch itself?
Well, my father used to get it done, I think, about every second year, you know, in the late summer, especially to get it done for the winter, you know. But now I think my brother is looking after it, and there's a huge problem with, first of all, getting thatchers. It's a German thatcher he has every year when he gets it done. The straw he had to get it up from Tipperary, and the rods or the reeds or whatever you call them come from Turkey, of all places.
Go away. They come all the way from Turkey.
Turkey, yeah. But I remember when my father used to thatch it, he used to grow his own, what they used to call Sally rods. I don't know if you're familiar with those.
Oh, yeah, the Sally rods. Yeah.
He used to cut those and steep them in water. And you had to steep them in water before you could use them for thatching. And the local man used to do the thatching. But, of course, now there's nobody taking up that skill anymore, you know.
So. No, but I wonder, are a lot of thatch roofs falling into disrepair just because?
Yeah, I've seen them driving around the country. I have seen them. It's a pity, you know. It's a pity.
It'd be a huge loss, won't it? Because it's
very expensive to maintain them. You know, there's a small grant from the Heritage Department, but it doesn't go anywhere near what it costs to attach them. You know.
Yeah, that's what Katie was saying. That it just doesn't. There's a lot of talk about preserving this heritage, but when it comes to actually putting money there.
He had to replace all the windows as well and got in all new windows, the same type of windows, you know, but all new ones, you know. And it's lovely. It's absolutely lovely and cosy.
Yeah, I don't know. Will I take a break now or? Yes, I'll take. Sorry, I'm told I'll take a break. Paul, stay there. We'll come back. We've more on this, but we'll take our quick break here.
Joe Duffy. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we were talking there to Paul and his memories of growing up in what sounds like the most idyllic circumstances with the hens and the ducks and the half door and the whitewashed thatched cottage. Gerard, good afternoon to you.
Hello, how are you?
Good. You are also privileged to be living in a thatched cottage.
Well, I'm sort of not living in it, but I do own a thatched cottage, which I upkeep. My little thatched cottage, which is called Chigeen-Chi, and it's in the Inishowen Peninsula, just outside Carndonagh. And I actually make my house available for guests that come to visit here, you know, the peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
This little cottage is a protected structure. It was built in the mid-1600s.
Now, in the mid-1600s?
Yeah.
That must be one of the oldest
It's one of the oldest thatch, currently thatch houses. I don't know about Ireland, but certainly on the Inishowen Peninsula, there's two thatch cottages. One is another one's about maybe 150 feet away from me, and they're both the same age. If you look at it online, you can see it. It comes up on Google. It's T-I-G-I for the N-T-U-I, which is Chigin Chi, small thatched house. And I think that nearly all my guests go away thinking, wow, this guy's just sold them a memory for life, you know?
And the issue that our other callers there are having, the insurance issue, is that an issue up there?
It isn't an issue because we can't get it. You just can't get it. It beggars belief that this is a protected structure and I have an absolute legal responsibility to maintain it, or I can be held accountable for non-maintenance, and it's at my cost, not the Department of Heritage's. I have to say with the caveat that I do get a small amount of money to help me thatch it every 6 years. I get about maybe 25% of the total cost. But I took on this responsibility and I do it absolutely willingly.
Gerard? How much does it cost to rethatch?
I would expect the next time at about between 8,000 and 9,000 euros.
Right. And who does that for you? Is there somebody local there that can do it?
The best thatcher in Ireland, a man called Brian Lafferty, from Redcastle and the Inishowen Peninsula also. Brian is amazing. He's been thatching all his life. And, you know, I hope he's not listening. He's also getting up in years, you know, and looking to retire, but almost impossible to get anyone to come into the trade. Very, very difficult. Very difficult to get someone to look at it as a livelihood.
But what a wonderful way to make a living, though, on the roofs of these gorgeous cottages around the country.
And what a wonderful, piece of heritage. If my little thatch house was a golden crown just found, it would be surrounded by security in the National Museum. And it would be protected with all the costs that could be thrown at it. But we do not see the value and the importance of this heritage.
Honestly, Gerard, I had no idea that there was any thatch cottages in this country dating back to the 1600s. That is just a mind-blowing thought that it has been protected and is here from that time.
Yeah. Well, it's there to see, what do we do about it? We can do something about it, to be honest, and it's called the 1990 Derelict Buildings Act. In 1990, a piece of legislation was brought in for the very purpose of stopping buildings becoming derelict or vacant. And there is a legal responsibility on every single local authority to have a register of vacant and derelict buildings. And there is a penalty of up to 10% of the value of that property if you fail to maintain it or let it go to wreck and ruin. And you'll be surprised to hear that in the last 32 years since that piece of legislation came into force, not a single piece of paper has ever been issued to anyone in and all I can speak for is Donegal. Donegal County Council have never served a notice on anyone in the last 32 years, despite the fact that this mandatory legislation was brought in.
Think that there's a bigger story to that, I think, in terms of dereliction and housing.
But could you imagine? There's 29,000 buildings in Donegal currently, not derelict, vacant. Now, what they mean by vacant is that they contain the windows and doors, that they're still somewhat habitable. Could you imagine if those vacant buildings were bringing in 100 euros a year. That would be 2.5 to 3 million euro a year. Hey, we wouldn't need an insurance company. All we would need is self-insurance.
I could talk to you all day, Gerard, but unfortunately I can't because I'm actually way over time. And I know I've Mary, I couldn't get to you, Mary. We have more people coming in on this. Many people with a lot to say about this great heritage that we need to protect, but we're not doing it. But that's all we have time for. Today's programme was produced by Annette Egan. Elaine Conlon is broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound. Stand by now for Ray Darcy.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.